Hello, hello, and hello, everybody. Welcome back for another episode, If Not Now, When. In today's show, I am so excited to have my friend Nick Spiller join us today. Nick is a venture principal for Capital Factory. He's a veteran for the Texas startup ecosystem and the biggest startup supporters. Most of his days spending to help founders through raising the capital, and as a venture principal, he worked at the most active C-stage venture capital fund in Texas, Capital Factory. Today, you know, through Capital Factory, they help over 750 portfolio companies raising billions in venture capital, plus over half of a billion in non-dilutive funding from defense and government innovation groups. He's super passionate about creating an inclusive startup ecosystem in Austin and the world. With that, everybody, please join me to welcome Nick to the show. Thank you so much, Nick, for joining us today. We are so excited to have you.
Thanks for having me, Wen.
Yeah. So tell us, Nick, how does all that start for you?
Well, I grew up in a small town outside of Flint, Michigan, in the Midwest. I graduated high school in the midst of the financial crisis in 2009. And long story short, the best school I got into is the University of Texas at Austin. And I moved down sight unseen. And that coincidentally happened to be the year that my boss now, Joshua Bayer, was founding Capital Factory. And it was also 1 year before Dr. Bob Metcalf, the inventor of Ethernet, moved to Austin and became the professor of innovation. And Dr. Metcalf and Joshua Bayer teamed up to start a class, which is now called Longhorn Startup. And I was a student entrepreneur in that course the first year they held it. And I'm still involved in that course today as a mentor. I'm going there this afternoon.
Wow. That's all that come together.
That was the beginning, yes. And it was great timing on my part and really just showed up to help and see, you know, how I could assist in this vision of making Austin a better Silicon Valley.
Yeah. And why that interest to you, Nick?
Yeah, well, growing up outside of Flint, it's quite opposite than the economic environment we benefit from here in Austin. Today, for sure, and even in 2009 when I moved here, Flint is the birthplace of General Motors. And in the 50s, it was the fastest growing city in the United States. It was built on one industry, though, and that was the automotive industry. And over time, those jobs ended up going overseas and really left this, you know, struggling economy with high unemployment, significant crime. And when I was going to college, I wanted to really figure out how to fix that. Why is that? That was a big question on my mind. In fact, that's what I wrote about when I applied to the University of Texas in my essay. And it was, you know, why is Austin thriving through this recession, you know, from an economic standpoint, and what could come, back to Flint to revitalize our economy there. And so it did not take long living in Austin to realize the answer to that question was entrepreneurship, technology, and innovation.
Wow. And I know today you are such a veteran, right, for startup ecosystem in Austin and beyond. Why do you have such a strong belief in Austin and also specifically entrepreneurship with that?
Well, when it comes to my career in startups in Austin, it's built on the idea that Silicon Valley needed to expand. And
tell us more.
Silicon Valley is a very unique place, and there's been more wealth created there than really anywhere in the history of time. And it's there's only so many people and so many billion-dollar companies you can build in one city, one geographic area. And I think, you know, Silicon Valley has been distributing itself across the United States and even beyond our borders for quite some time. And that's really kicked in here the last few years, the last 10 years. When I moved here in 2009, there was a large migration to Texas from the Midwest. I was part of that. And there's a lot of other people who are moving here. And there was this early inklings of this coastal migration here. And I'm not saying Austin is replacing San Francisco or New York as the hub. I'm saying it's spreading out, and that Austin is simply the leading alternative to those markets. And mm-hmm. you see startup ecosystems popping up in almost everywhere across the country now. And that's what I mean about, Silicon Valley expanding itself. And it's been obvious here that Austin's had a head start building our ecosystem and Austin is no stranger to technology, with our own similar background, to Silicon Valley with some Department of Defense work here. In the 70s, 80s, IBM moving here, some early companies, Dell, Trilogy, Tivoli, and there's MCC, the Microcomputing Electronics Consortium, moved to Austin in the 80s. And so there was a lot of groundwork that was laid here for the tech ecosystem. We hadn't hit our prime yet. There weren't these billion-dollar companies that had transformed the face of the earth that Silicon Valley had, but you could see the trend was our friend, and I figured I'd hang out and see how I could help.
Yeah, and it's quite incredible. You had that vision 2009. Do you always see that?
No, I didn't have any vision in 2009. Barely was coherent. It feels like coming out of high school and all the shenanigans in college. But Dr. Bob Metcalf had a vision and Joshua Bayer had a vision. I was lucky enough to glimpse that through showing up to an event and listening to a panel and a keynote. And I just knew that I could connect people at the end of the day and that I could play a role because mm-hmm. Josh and Dr. Metcalf are busy people. They need a lot of help. There wasn't a lot of infrastructure on campus, or they didn't have big teams helping them do this at mm-hmm. the time. They had small teams, and so I was able to step up and literally do things like fold clothes in the swag closet at Capital Factory in the early days. And mm-hmm. I did that, so I got a VIP pass to the startup crawl, or got into an event, or there's ways to just help out. And mm-hmm. And most lasting way to help out was to get the student body involved and. With Dr. Metcalf and Josh's support, I was able to rally a group of student leaders to create the Longhorn Entrepreneurship Agency and Student Government. Wow. And that is really, still around today and the organization that resulted from a lot of those early activities that I was a part of.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I love that. And you're not only, really having that passion to help, but really recognizing the thought leader early on, really saying yes to their vision, their impact to the world, and help you see the impact you create today.
People get very focused on the visionary, and because it's fascinating, and that's why we make movies and watch movies about people like Steve Jobs and Elon Musk. But what I've noticed is that there's far more people who are not founders and are not visionaries involved in startups.
That's equally important.
Right. And I actually think it's far more important is that the people know how to help those with a vision. Mm-hmm. And that's where 90% of the work is done mm-hmm. by people on the ground who, get very little credit relative to, mm-hmm. The picture of a founder and the reputation of a founder. And I'm not trying to take anything away from that. I think mm-hmm. there's a big reason we celebrate the founders, and it's a cultural beacon. But most people in startups are not founders.
Yeah, that's a great distinction there, because I think you're right. A lot of those kudos and lights going to those visionaries, and they are wonderful. They are one of the kind. But I really believe that it takes a village rising up, especially in a startup, in the startup ecosystems. And in my personal belief, I think there are kind of three types of person. I think we kind of speaking of that before is, of course, you having that visionary, as I call it, the top of triangle, who are, can see something from nothing and having that brilliant idea from left to right, which is amazing and wonderful. That's their gift. But you also have to have, I call it, the operational geniuses, where he thrive or she thrive on systems, structures. If you said, Nick, I'm going to the moon, I said, great one. There are three steps. 1, 2, 3, that's how we arrive to the moon. So that is the gift that I call it operational geniuses, they brought on the table. Right. Last but not least, we also have someone I call it the people leader. He or she thrive in people. He or she thrive in community. He or she thrive on sharing their vision with the world. So if you take a step back, think about those three triangles, right? One person here as a visionary said, okay, guys, we are going to the moon. Great. Now, the operational genius said, brilliant. There are three steps. We're going to do 1, 2, 3. We're going to get there in XYZ times. Now, the people leader are going to take that vision, take the ideas to now share that with the entire world. Mm. Guys, at organization ABC, this is what we do. Love to have you join us in this mission.
Right.
So if you think about that three triangle, it really completes the entire team. And I love what you said about, you know, the visionary actually is a quote-unquote minority, nor good or bad. It's more like a three-leg stool almost. You have to have both to stand on.
Right, right. And you know, reinforcement of those legs that you're standing on. Do you think that one person could play two or three
100%.
Of those?
100%. So, you know, typically speaking, once again, we are so generalizing here, which I don't like that because no one is a box. So we all are so different. But generally speaking, any individuals will have one that's predominantly and usually have one or two. So for example, I'm going to see myself. I know I am the people leader. That's just someone that, you know, I thrive with leader, with people, with connection. But also I'm not visionary in my own mind. I understand what vision I want to create for the world I'm creating. But once again, you know, there's no one tree is better than another. It's just what we naturally gravitate to. And therefore it is important whether it's a partnership or a friendship or a team or the group, we want to make sure find the right partner that really complements us. You know, from different angles.
Mm.
So from that, I'm going to throw the question back to you, Nick. What do you think, just by a first step on it, what do you think is your like a primary driver or maybe secondary or third?
Well, I want to know what you think. What do you think I am?
Well, first of all, we do be friends for some times.
But I
want also preface on this. The more experienced people get in life, people get more well-rounded.
Yeah.
So people could, I'm speaking this for myself, like I could start with as a people leader, for example, after, you know, being startup in corporate and MBA, all the fancy things. I understand structure, understand how things work, but it's not going to be what I love to do, but I can be organized. So really this is not about a strength or weakness kind of thing. It's more like what is your natural strength. Maybe that's, I want to put it that way. What do you like versus...
Right.
You're good at.
I think I'm also a people person.
I was just going to say it's pretty obvious to me that you always that I see you as a people leader in a startup community. You rally everyone around and create all the what is event assignments, showcase all the best of technology. I think you are this. I don't want to say it's cheerleader because I feel like a put down, but you are this biggest advocate behind those innovation and startup.
I agree, and you know. Bringing people together and you know, someone has to get the tribe excited and, you know, communicate, you know, to the group in unison. But what I've really tried to do is use my, you know, natural gift for people to become a dynamic leader who can really play all three of those roles. And today I look at what you just described as very situational more than a team building thing. And it's like, what is my situation on this team and this project in this moment? And, you know, really being able to step up in either one of those roles based on what's needed.
And I do
feel like I have a little bit of a vision now for Texas. And certainly, you know, probably that's, I like to let my vision shine through the people I work with and make my friends famous. I've learned the hard way on ops, the 1, 2, 3, how do you go do it question. And I've, because I was not technical nor anything special, I had to start in startups in operations. And when I got my first job at Favors, I was at Favor Delivery, it was operations manager. And I was delivering, you know, anything, food usually from a restaurant. And we were doing it, you know, a couple hundred times a day or, you know, sometimes a couple thousand times a day across the company. And so
that's insane. Math.
Yeah. It's a lot. It's the operation, right? And, and if you do it right, it doesn't feel too hard. And the growth doesn't hurt. And, you know, and certainly Capital Factory is unique in that I am investing in startups out of our fund and working with them as an advisor, but we have a big operation and a 75 person team that I also help manage. And it's, you know, quite complex as well. So I think it's, it's like you kind of, what is your natural you know, answer to that. What is your natural mm-hmm. Leader type? And then, you know, how do you use that to develop these other, those other areas so you're well-rounded?
Yeah, no, it's brilliant, Seth, because I think at the end of the day, you and me, we are all, everybody, we all wear multiple hats in different scenarios, and there are different situations call us a different strengths forward. But once again, the more experience we have, the more well-rounded we naturally become. But there are still differentiate between what we really love to do versus I can be good at it, but I might not love to do. For me, I know it's spreadsheet. Like I understand it, I can read it, but please don't put me like build a pivot table. Like for the love of God, don't put me in that task.
Yeah.
But if I have to do it, I will. So I think there's just a how to best use of time.
Yeah.
That's why we do put it.
Yeah. At the end of the day, it is a job, and jobs because there are unfun parts, and mm-hmm. it is nice. To have fun at work, but it's not always going to be fun. And you know, you got to, mm-hmm. Kind of just be able to buckle in and focus on those things that you don't want to do. And the more you're able to put it in practice, flex that muscle, the easier it gets. And soon enough, it's not even a big deal.
Yeah, I think that applies a lot for entrepreneurs, especially in the early stage.
The most for entrepreneurs.
Maybe like one, maybe two person, maybe not even that, just two or three, if they're lucky, they gather well-rounded, diverse, you know, skill set, or maybe not in the first beginning, right?
Right.
So the founder has to do the part that maybe quote-unquote unfun, like you said, and you are 100% right. Oftentimes, when you think about it, it's never just about you and me, it's about the bigger vision. And if we can focus on the big picture, right, those unfun part could be fun in the process of it.
It's such an important point in that, the founders have to be more adaptable than anybody, and they need to be willing to do any job at any stage. And you know, it's where we always should remind ourselves that founder is a status, not a job.
What a quote! I love that.
Yes, and it's not even a job title, really. It's
status.
It's very, you know, CEO is a job.
Yeah,
you know, CTO is a job.
Mm-hmm.
Like people don't get a salary for being a founder; they mm-hmm. get equity, and it's a very special role, but it's not a job.
Mm-hmm.
And the role, and often the founder does have the job of CEO or CTO or a different executive level job. But the interesting thing that you get to see working across companies of all stages is the job of the CEO in the early stages is vastly different than the job of the CEO at the late stage, and really. The tough part is like you spend all this time solving these problems, becoming a leader at the seed phase or, you know, after your Series A. And then once you figure that all out, you got to level up and the problem set completely changes. And as soon, you know, and it's just like a video game. It's like, oh, I finally figured it out. But, oh, well, guess what? Like level up, you got to go do something completely different. It's not about getting from, you know, 100,000 to a million. It's about getting a million to 5 million. It's not about, you know, then it's 5 million to 20 million. And it's, you know, it's way different to lead a 20-person team than a 50-person team than a 500-person team and the management layers. And so, the reality is that companies grow faster than people a lot of good founders have to hire people to do these executive jobs while they find other jobs within the organization or move on to their next job, their next startup or something else. And we'll always be the founder of that company. You can't, that's kind of what the point of it. It's like jobs you can take away and that's an accountable, you know, there's accountability, but you can't take, you know, can't make someone not the founder.
What a great insight, Nick, because I think because you are such a veteran in the startup scenes and you've seen it all, right? From different kind of, vertical, different type of founder, different kind of strengths all in above. And what you share is so interesting because I think a lot of founders, when they find that status in the first place, he actually might not even anticipate that in the next, you know, XYZ years. And I'm curious, as a founder listening to this show, what are some, I don't want to say blind spot, but what are something that maybe surprised founder before he or she step into that role? Because what you said, one thing that probably not even commonly be anticipated.
Well, one easy thing is on your business card, your email signature, you should be putting CEO before founder. And you know, just to, you know, my perspective, knowing that founder is a status, not a role, is that, that, you know, when the founder puts founder first, that, that means that that is where their head's at and that's what they're prioritizing. And it's not this CEO mentality, which is different. And, I do feel like 80% of founders put founder and CEO, and I'm not saying this is a hard and fast rule, but, you know, if you go look at well-funded companies, like their CEOs will be putting CEO only. And they won't be putting founders, even if, you know, they may, and they may put founders after. So, you know, you know, the broader point is there's a lot of nuances of how you present yourself that investors begin to pick up on. And, I'm not saying any of it's a, you know, deal breaker whatsoever, but it's mm-hmm. certainly something if I, you know, if I see that, I'm like, okay, mm-hmm. you know, there's a little, maturing, you know, that I would like to see, most likely there. And, you know, I don't think it effectually damages anybody. And I don't think this is a widespread belief, but, it is something that I've always thought of. And it's something that, you know, someone I mentioned multiple times, on the call, Dr. Metcalf, shared with me originally and pointed out.
What Dr. Metcalf inspired you the most, Nick? Because you have such a, I don't want to say privileges, but you have such a, you know, interesting, you know, time spending with him in a very intimate setting, you know, very early on.
I'm very, very fortunate and was one of the first students to meet Dr. Metcalf when he came to University of Texas. And, you know, for those of you who don't know him, he is the inventor of Ethernet, started a company called 3Com that became a unicorn in Silicon Valley and established the internet as we know it. And he's been a venture capitalist, a publisher, and spent 10 years at the University of Texas at Austin as professor of innovation. And I went to one of the first events he spoke at when he got that job. And what inspired me the most is when he said his mission at UT is to make our student entrepreneurs as supported and celebrated as our student athletes. Mm. Right? Which ties directly back to my earlier comment about there being more people who support founders than there are founders themselves. And the lifeblood of our magnificent athletics program at the University of Texas is not, the athletes are critical, but it is about the fans and it's about the alumni. It's about the 100,000 people that show up to watch people play a game, right? And all of that. And so, and that's the true way to build a startup ecosystem is to actually figure out how you get the people around the founders to mm-hmm. be more founder friendly. And, mm-hmm. You might find, you know, versus having, you know, founder centric problems like, oh, this founder needs to raise money faster. Well, maybe there's things we can do from an ecosystem level to make the funding more accessible or make the funding process more equitable. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever it may be, but yeah, I think it's, you know, we want our entrepreneurs to be as supportive as our athletes. And the second, less collegial, you know, thing that inspired me was his mission to make Austin a better Silicon Valley. And you know, he started that in 2011 and, you know, I think we're well on our way, if not already there.
And now you take the pecan over.
I would say there's a whole army of people who've taken the baton.
But still, you're one of the ones that really, you know, once again, it's not about everyone leading, it's we all leading together forward, right? But today, you know, being the venture principals at Capital Factory, the center of gravity to Austin, but entire Texas startup ecosystems, your voice, your perspective have a huge gravity there.
I've been a witness to it all, and I witness, and I intend to stay alive as long as I can to come on podcast and talk about it and share the story.
You are so humble, Nick. I mean, you've done a lot. You rallied so many incredible people together to celebrate those amazing, you know, innovations and achievements. But yeah, you know, I feel like you are such a humble leadership to really shed the light on all those amazing people, and yet really set the groundwork for everyone to rise up together.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you ultimately find it's far more powerful to make the people around you grow than you, because there's more people around you than there are you. So there's far more growth at stake. And this, again, not to harp on Dr. Metcalf, but Metcalf's law, right? And the more nodes in your network, the more powerful your network. And so, that's a view I developed early on. It works. And you know, I think it's, you make your friends famous, and it's worth it in and of itself.
Yeah, and I think that's why, Nick, you are so well loved in the startup ecosystem, the community, and all and above. So,
well, thank you.
Incredible job. But with that, let's talk about investment. Let's talk about fundable, right?
Right.
I know why today you spend most of your time supporting and helping those founders to get capital. Tell us about that process.
Yeah, well, it makes it really confusing to know if founders really love me or they just want to meet investors. So I appreciate you saying that.
All in above. Yes and yes.
You know, and I love the founders who are just trying to get investors, and you know, I don't need them to love me, a lot of times it's easier if they don't. Well, and I just say that, and that, like, what I've learned is it's, you know, when you build an emotional relationship with someone, you feel obligated. And as a connector, my obligation in that sense makes zero impact on the value of the connections that I can make.
Mm.
And it actually biases my decisions on which connections I can make.
Mm.
And so,
interesting.
Yeah. And so it actually is far easier for me to look at this, these on paper, and certain, you know, and I, you know, interact with the founders, but I'm frankly a fan of developing a personal relationship after I've gotten them a 6 or 7 figure investor. and that's the great time. And if I can, like, meet you for the first time, like, outside of work for a drink and develop a relationship to celebrate the funding, that's my goal. And it ultimately, what's unique about what we do at Capital Factory and my team is the scale at which we do this.
How does it work?
At any one time, we probably have about 100 companies that are raising money in the marketplace, more probably that we don't even know about. And we have an investor relations team who has a Asana project with every one of those rounds documented, with direct information from the founders, and a very clear process for supplementing and really, in a lot of cases, launching the funding rounds for those founders. Every day, probably as we speak, we're chipping away at that, and, you know, one company at a time. And what is critical to make that work on the front end is that the companies are well vetted, and, you know, we know what our investor network wants. We, you know, kind of filter around that when we're engaging companies for our advisory program. And then we have direct data from over 1,000 VCs and angels that we have relationships with, that have understand Capital Factory, we've invested in, they've came to our events. They filled out a form that we gave them with our data on what they invest in. And we only share deals that fit that. And it's very, and, you know, the founders basically work with our team to develop their profile and using the same tagging system and all that. So we're able to use a very data-centric approach to curating this full list of 1,000 investors. Whereas, you know, as an individual, I can't process that many potential connections. Take a lot of brain power if I did. It's like, okay, project management, you know, getting this data flow and the curation, you know, data-driven curation process down. And then, you know, if you're only sharing good deals with investors, or, you know, and good is a subjective term. Let's just say you're only sharing deals that fit the criteria the investors gave you on paper or on the form, then you're doing the investor's job for them, and you've created a really good service, and we become pen pals with these investors. And there's these investors all over the world that we send deals to, and they respond, and we have little conversations, and every day, you know, there's 10, 20 of those conversations, a few of us on the team that manage these campaigns. And that's just a really effective way to build a relationship with an investor and add value. And, you know, if 1 in 10 of those becomes an investment, that's a home run. And, you know, reality, it might be 1 in 20, 1 in 30. And, but, you know, the point is, we're we're delivering on the most number of potential connections in the network, and you know, doing it in a way where we're making hundreds of connections a week, and and we're not spamming investors, and we're keeping them engaged, and it's I don't know if that might sound like chaotic, and it is, but we make it work.
Wow, what a massive project to rebuild a connection in a meaningful way and establish a network globally. And let's talk about startup, because I know today, you know, Nick, you not only connect with all the incredible men and women from all over the world want to invest in those right technology, but you also personally support, advise, and mentor many of those amazing founders. And in your perspective, right, what are fundable startups? What are startups that have, I don't want to say most potential, because everyone have amazing potential, but when we think about funding aspect.
Maybe start by what's not fundable.
Okay. What is not,
is
yes.
easier, or at least,
yes.
What is not going to be the next unicorn, right?
Well,
certainly it's not the last unicorn.
Okay.
Right. And I think this is the biggest, right? I think one of the biggest things people do, and I'm not saying there aren't patterns to key in on.
Tell us about pattern. I'm very curious about that.
Well, VCs are built on patterns, and mm-hmm. We see a lot of deals, and there's no true equation, or there's not a financial history to evaluate, and so there's a lot of patterns, and like the job title pattern is just one that I mentioned, and just seeing how they put in founder first, CEO first, like, and there's a thousand of those probably that we pick up on, just soft things. And a lot of them I'm probably not even aware of.
Tell us couple big ones.
A couple big ones.
Well, yeah, that's unfundable.
Like the biggest thing that's unfundable is uncoachability, It's especially if you're not coachable and you're not like charming or super genius or have like some redeeming factor for being kind of an a-hole, right? Like
oh my god,
a-holes like make big companies, but usually like there's a bunch of exceptions, and then that is the exception, because the reality is people who build big companies are great leaders, and they work with people and they inspire people. And, and again, going back to the difference between the founder and the CEO, like the people that are taking it public are leaders. I think coachability is really important. And I think in the startup community, we just get caught up on these like legacy business models. And we think that,
what do you mean?
Well, like right now.
What is legacy business model?
Legacy business models, maybe even just legacy trends or, right now, let's just say there's a rush towards conversational AI.
Oh, yeah. So much.
Right. And because there's this unicorn, OpenAI. Well, OpenAI is a unicorn, right? They've accomplished that, right? And there's people rushing to go get into this space when effectually it's over, right? And I think there are big steps in AI to come and unstructured AI, but the next unicorn is not going to be a conversational AI platform, in my opinion, and because we already have that and it's figured out, and they're going to keep growing, and they're still just getting started, but like the race is won, and so you got to look beyond it, right? And so many people in the startup community chase these trends. And a year ago was Web3, right? And a year before that, it was who knew,
right?
The pandemic, right? And it was chasing the pandemic and what opportunities came out of the pandemic. And then a year before that, it was VR, AR, right? But it's usually these trends come because there's big companies that have made a breakthrough and have been working on this space for 10 years, and they've built the unicorn already, and now it's enabled. And, you're at the application layer at that point, meaning that, people are building applications on OpenAI, which can be very strong businesses and create a lot of cash flow and transform companies. I don't think it's, you can't, that doesn't mean it's a unicorn, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not saying there's not maybe, there might be a unicorn built on top of OpenAI, but like there's an, it's not because it just does the chatbot thing well, right? Or not just because it uses OpenAI in
like, I know exactly what
one
you
specific
meant.
Way. It's like maybe they like use OpenAI to like integrate with something else and add some other new idea on top of it, then okay, then maybe you have it. But, and I think we try to get, very comparative on these just early stage companies and, even just, the milestones people look at of like, oh, what have they accomplished and what are their valuation? And you really got to have a forward facing mentality and really have a view of the future that you're building into. Mm-hmm. And that has to be somewhat accurate of a hypothesis and
understood,
and see where the puck is going, not where the puck is at, right?
Yeah.
And because like that's the one place it won't be is where it's at now, and so
that's a great point.
It could be all these other places.
Yeah, so definitely that I call it shining subject symptom, where we are
right
today. This and I hear your point loud and clear that if right now it's already here, next it will be I don't want to say a moving target. It's not actually that way, but it feels like us, we are chasing a trend rather than actually dedicate time and energy to recreate something meaningful.
Right. Yeah. And the trends, you can dig in and there's a few, tier two winners in these trends.
But they're not tier one.
They're not. Yeah. They're not tier one. Social media is another, well played out example of this, mm-hmm, where you had Facebook and Twitter, in all of our hands and everyone was using it, and yet people were still trying to start the next social media company. And you could even, this is a, area where Silicon Valley could have diversified, and there are people that just say like for a long time, these like in Silicon Valley, they were just building consumer apps and they're really good at that. And they made a lot of money and they could launch it. But the reality is those aren't that innovative anymore. And it's like the innovation has turned more industrial, supply chain focused, deep technology. And these are things that, California is not set up to build as easily as places like Texas or a lot of these other new startup ecosystems that are evolving.
Mm-hmm. And how do you compare the startup ecosystem in terms of the strengths and advantage? As you speak about Silicon Valley versus Austin versus other places.
Well,
even Silicon Valley to Austin, for example, how do you compare that? If people ask you, should I go to Silicon Valley? Should I go to Austin? How do you answer that question?
Austin's more accessible.
Mm.
And I'm not going to say if, you're going to put Silicon Valley startups on a field with Austin startups that Austin would beat those startups, but I can tell you if you want to break into VC and break into startups, you want to come to Austin. And it's earlier in its growth cycle as an ecosystem, and there very well may, and I hope will be, another growth cycle for Silicon Valley on the West Coast. But the reality is in 2018-ish, the population of tech workers in San Francisco started to decrease. And which is the ultimate limiting factor on how many unicorns you can build is like, how many people can you hire to work at the unicorns? Right. And like and that's why you have it in a certain city, because you're building, Austin, there's a lot more room for growth on that. And there's so many people moving here, mm-hmm, but a lot of them work in tech and a lot of them are educated and a lot of them are moving here to get involved in the startup community and in tech. And so there's just way more, of a green field to work in here, mm-hmm, versus Silicon Valley, which, is just a much more exclusive culture.
Yeah. So back to the investment piece, we talk about founders or teams who are maybe not as founder, but we talk about two things. We talk about one, uncoachable. Secondly, maybe tracing the trend all and above. Now let's talk about teams that are really exciting for you when it comes to raising capital, when it comes to funding, right? What are the top few traits that you guys are looking at?
Yeah, I think it all routes back to trust with the team. And
so the people.
It's the people, and that's the one thing that's more like more important than a, you know, amazing high growing business, right? That, you know, the business has a good idea. It's got a lot of great customers. But if you don't trust the people operating that company, it doesn't matter, right? And there's plenty of examples you can look at where there's people who took money from investors and they weren't trustworthy, right? And you know, in VC and beyond. And so, you know, and then it becomes, okay, how do you evaluate trust and how do you test trust? And working in at a place that like Capital Factory is so community driven, and we have hundreds of mentors and hundreds of founders and investors we've worked with that we do trust. We have a trust network. And so if, you know, you send me someone when like, hey, this person's awesome. Like, I really like what they're doing and I've worked with them before and it's great. Like, okay, like we kind of trust this person from the start. Right. And we kind of know who sends what type of deal flow. And like some people like will send us a lot of deal flow and we still love to get, you know, introductions, but we just know like, oh, they don't maybe have as deep of a relationship as another mentor that only, you know, shares, you know, really trusted things. You know, and then the other big thing for keeping trust is, or for building trust is keeping your promises. And I recommend you start small instead of big with your promises, and instead of promising the world, like promise that you'll be on time or promise that you'll send a follow-up email by the end of the day and do it.
I'm so adamant about this. Like when people tell me, okay, when I will do X, Y, Z after this, no problem, and nothing happens. It's just like, we just talk about this, or even send a follow-up email, but still nothing happened.
Right.
That for me is like, it's just such a big no-no.
This is your strike zone, and this is 100%. why founders should talk with you, because there's a lot of just basics that are easy that can, you know, really create a huge false start. And yeah,
it's just who we are, right? You know, we are our words. I really think that's such a big thing, and I love you said about start small, don't be that big.
Yeah, because you just ultimately, when you invest in a company, you need to understand the accuracy of the information you're getting from the CEO, and there's you can't, you know, go to a earnings report or, you know, like you're just getting it from the CEO, and that's why it's risky. And, you know, public investors, you know, retail investors aren't able to do it because you have to have some type of accreditation status to participate because it's risky. And a lot of founders just go promise everything. And I don't even think they're realizing, like, if they say they're going to do something as a CEO of a company, they're promising it. Like if you say it's going to, you know, and, you know, certainly there's like different levels of it, but if you don't qualify that statement and say, you know, oh, this is just a pipe dream, we're not really going to do this, but this would be awesome. Right. Then, you know, you start to like build this up and all of a sudden as an investor, you just don't know what's fact or fiction. And like, we're always kind of like incorporating a little bit of fiction and like, you know, a little like, you know, creative fiction, I'd say, or just like creative nonfiction where you're making it interesting and you may exaggerate a little bit, but you don't cross the line into an outright lie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a very important distinction, I think. I just recently watched the show where it's called We Crush. I don't know if you're watching it. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, you should. It's on Apple TV. It's talk about how we work, their story.
Oh, and I did see it.
And I thought it was such a great... So watch it. I was curious to talk to you afterwards about the line between aspiration versus maybe not so much.
Right. Yeah. And it goes both ways.
100%.
With WeWork, it's interesting.
We can talk more once you watch that.
Yeah. No, I have watched it now that I understand. Oh. And I'm very familiar with the WeWork story. I misheard you. But yeah, I personally, I think there's a lot of blame that should be put on the investors that wasn't. And a lot of people focus on Adam Neumann. And
I thought he's a dreamer.
He's a dreamer. And
I admire that. That's a lot of gut.
Right, right. He, you know, this is an example of a company that grew faster than the CEO, and their CEO didn't find a new CEO that could do the job at the higher level.
Yeah.
And that was permitted by the board. It's quite unfortunate because it goes back to the people around founders, not giving them the right help. And Adam Neumann changed the way we work, and he created an incredible company that grew incredibly fast. And he really did more than most founders. And there's, you know, I could count on 10 founders, right. And you look at absolute value, he grew, he crushed it. He was not a financial, person. And, it's a community game. Mm-hmm. I think I would not take trust lessons from Adam Neumann, but there is a bigger story that you can get into. And investors, maybe we're a little too trusting with him. And that's definitely part of the problem.
I mean, they always lesson everything everywhere, right? I don't think it's anything as simple as right or wrong. It just is. And I think one of the good things out of that is today the co-working culture becomes so readily accessible for everybody, especially startup community and founders, which is something I really appreciate at Capital Factory. Right. And now I'm curious, Nick, with all that, right, you has been in Austin ecosystem for decades. Is it 2 decades now, if I count my math correctly?
Not quite 2. almost 15 years.
Yeah. Well, that is quite some time. You've seen a lot. You've done a lot. And now I'm curious, what are you most excited about next, about the future?
The commercialization of outer space.
Wow, that's very specific.
There's some people who fall in love with the idea of outer space, and I did that somewhere along the line, just out of curiosity. Mm. And we are in a space race, and the United States is going to land on the moon this year for the first time since the first time in 1969, just in our portfolio alone, 3 of our companies are funded as part of that mission.
Wow.
And one of them is a public company that you can invest in right now called Intuitive Machines, that is building the lander and a telecommunication system for the moon.
Incredible.
Yeah. And that's as venture capital of an industry as it gets, I think. Mm. So I'm ready to rock.
I love that. I love that you have such a big mission and really rally the incredible founder technology towards that. That's really incredible to see. What do you personally want to leave on this planet with, Nick?
I don't know. Maybe it's what I want to leave off this planet. Going back to the space analogy.
I love that. Yeah. But what's specific, though? When people say 100 years later or 200 years later, when people think about Nick Spiller, what do you want the legacy to be?
Maybe like one book.
Okay.
Like if 100 years from now, if I wrote a really good book that people like look back on. And
but what is that? What's the thing of the book?
Well, it's probably the story about Austin and its role in the startup community. And I think I'm nothing special, have no real technical capabilities,
overrated, anyone. By the way.
And, but I've had, like I said, I'm an eyewitness to this, and I want to tell a story, and I'm still generally just witnessing and being part of the story and playing my little role on the team at Capital Factory. But
amazing.
Maybe it's a podcast, and who knows, maybe it's a, immortal AI version of myself and my consciousness that I leave and tells the story that way. But, something like a book that today, we see is like, there's the, Adam Smith and Wealth of Nations, right? Great book, lasted for a long, long time. And it's, the foundation of a whole way of thinking. And I don't know if, maybe it's more of a lifestyle that my book would be about.
Does not matter. Going to be you. That's all that matters, right?
Also doesn't matter because I won't be here. So I guess I don't think about it too much. But if you ask me, that's what I'd say.
Hey, you do you, whether it's the AI version of you, the book, the podcast, all in above, right? At the end of the day, you know, I think you're going to be truly one of the incredible, I don't want to say legacy, but like a flagship that really helped put Austin Peay, Texas on the map when we think about startup, when we think about startup ecosystems. And today, whether it's with Capital Factory or anything beyond that, you really a group of superstars around you and made that happen. That's really incredible.
Well, I'm lucky to have you on my team of superstars saying nice things, and really appreciate being on your show and your platform and everything you do for our community. We get great feedback from founders who work with you, and I really appreciate your perspective and your method to helping them grow. And excited to, you know, we'll see. You know, I wonder when the last person will listen to this podcast episode, if that will be 5 years from now, 50 years from now, 1,000 years from now.
That's an interesting thought.
Yeah. Huh? When will the last person that listens to this episode listen to it?
And we will never know.
not with the current physics.
No. Yeah, but I thought that's a beauty part, right? Oftentimes, life, there are so wonders and there's so much unknowns, and that's what made life so exciting. And therefore, I just want to say truly, sincerely, thank you, Nick. I have not done a show with friends for a long time on the show, and that just made me so happy. And just seeing you and seeing the truth coming out of you, seeing the passion, seeing all the incredible, the people, the passion all in above. So truly, Nick, thank you for being here today. I'm so appreciate you.
Thank you, Wynn. I had a blast.
Me too. And thank you everybody for tuning in today. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I do. And I cannot wait to see you all next week. Bye, guys.